Hey everybody, how's it going? Thanks for joining me this afternoon. I've got a great stream with a great guest that I think you're really going to enjoy. So the left have uncovered a diabolical plot. The press have uncovered the worst thing that the far right has on its agenda. They have this terrible, evil plan to go ahead and take over America, conquer democracy, get rid of all that we hold dear. And that plan, it seems, is to have children. Yes, they're very, very worried about people having families, having kids, reproducing, being happy, healthy, just family units inside society. And so I wanted to talk a little bit about why the left is so terrified of this. Why do progressives find healthy families, intact families, to be such terrible things? And joining me to do that today is the author of Domestic Extremism. She's a contributing editor over at The American Mind. Peachy Keenan, thanks for coming on.
Hi there. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So Politico had this absolutely insane hit piece about how, you know, the far right, it's done. It's done with the idea of elections. It's done with the idea of democracy. It's got a new and nefarious plan, the obsession with having children. Could you tell me a little bit about why you and the many people who attended this pro-natalist conference suddenly became targets for the left?
Yeah, that was hilarious. That article calling people like me who just want to have children and, you know, stop population decline are now far-right extremists. It just completely validates the title of my book, which was all about this, which was, it's just called Domestic Extremist, A Practical Guide to Winning the Culture War. And in that book, I make this exact case that really the only way out of our predicament, our cultural predicament, political, all of it, is for people to kind of remember kind of the traditional ways of being, traditional marriage, having more than one or two kids, and kind of reclaim that. And we don't really even have to reclaim it. We're still living the life that, let's say, our parents did, when it was normal to have, you know, stay married and have more than two kids. And the left has kind of like jettisoned those ideas for progressivism. And now they're shocked to see that some people haven't gone along with their plan. We're still trying to do, you know, the plan that kind of we were taught as children. And so it's hilarious that that makes us extremists. And I like to say I'm not a real domestic extremist. I'm just extremely domestic.
Well, and that's the far more dangerous variety for them right now, right? The domestic extremists. They want the people they can parade around as, you know, to possible terrorist threats to the Republic, right? The worst thing you could possibly be is a rural white person who is angry with the government, right? This is the boogeyman that they're wanting to shake in front of people. But that's the useful one. That's the one that has no real danger to the regime. It's the people who might actually build stable social structures, who might bring traditional values and a way of life that is far more attractive and you know, really wholesome to the average person. Those are the people that I think probably undermine a lot of what the current ideology stands for. Because if people can look at I'd say alternative, but really it's the traditional way of life, and see that it's something that it just offers more, is more fulfilling, is far more stable, then they, you know, they look at the things around them, the gross, you know, kind of garbage world that's being pushed out to them, and they say, this isn't something that I want to be involved in.
Right. And that's the irony, is that, in fact, like you said, we are a danger to the regime and to the powers that be in a way that is, I think, terrifying to them. And I think, and I go into this in my book, and I think the reason is, you know, as we know, study after study shows that, for example, women who are married tend to vote more conservative than women who are not married. Families, parents, people who have children tend to be more conservative and care more about the schools and what their kids are learning than people who have no children, people who have no, like I like to say, no kin in the game, right? These people have nothing to live for. They don't care about a legacy. They don't care about the future. They don't have anything to care about in the present either. And when you have a family, now you have something to protect and to conserve. And you can look around and see all these bad ideas out there, like you said, the garbage that we're living in now. You can take steps to protect yourself and your family from those things at the public school and just everywhere. And that is dangerous, because that produces a generation of children who are not getting the message that they want these children to get. They're not becoming brainwashed to think they can change their gender and becoming these kind of this sort of like mindless army for the regime. We're seeing this play out on college campuses all week of children who have been raised to kind of absorb all of these messages from feminism to activism, you know, radical far left political ideology. And what that turns them into is just these kind of mindless robots, you know, tearing down in institutions and really society. And so by becoming, by staying traditional, by having a family, you're really protecting yourself. And it's really, you know, I think of my children as becoming basically immunized. You know, I've kind of given them a vaccine to the bad, the worst part of our culture.
Absolutely. I want to go a little more into how the family has now been politicized and why it's so critical to break down that structure, because I think you're exactly right that it does provide a barrier that really worries kind of the powers that be, because it does protect children from becoming kind of these mindless zombies that are going to follow that ideology where it leads. But before we do, guys, let me tell you a little bit about today's sponsor. Hey guys, I don't know about you, but I'm at the point in my life where I can't really afford to have a rough morning after hanging out and having a few drinks with the guys. ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink is the world's first genetically engineered probiotic. It was invented by scientists to tackle rough mornings after drinking. Here's how it works. When you drink, alcohol gets converted into a toxic byproduct in your gut. And it's that byproduct, not just dehydration, that's to blame for your rough next day. ZBiotics produces an enzyme to break down that byproduct. So just remember to make ZBiotics your first drink of the night, drink responsibly, and you'll feel your best tomorrow. If I want to grab drinks with friends and make sure I'm on top of my game the next morning, I grab ZBiotics first. Vacations, weddings, birthdays, reunions, there's a lot going on this spring, so make sure to stock up on ZBiotics. You can go to zbiotics.com/Oren to get 15% off your first order when you use Oren at checkout. ZBiotics is backed with 100% money-back guarantee, so if you're unsatisfied for any reason, they'll refund your money, no questions asked. So remember to head to zbiotics.com/Oren and use the promo code Oren at checkout for 15% off. So, like you were saying, it seems like the regime is particularly worried about intact, healthy family structures, because a lot of what is important to the message right now is the breaking down of all bonds and all identity, right? Mm-hmm. You have to make sure that every kid is programmable by the media and, you know, consumerist culture from the bottom up. Anytime they need to switch things up, new message, new plan, they need to be able to just kind of blow into, you know, educational systems and everything, deliver that. They don't want parents. They don't want anything that hinders that. They certainly don't want religion or any barriers that would naturally kind of stand between that. And so in that respect, you understand how family got political. But it does seem very strange that the, you know, a government that is supposed to expect to have a future, right, which is relying on to some degree population growth. You know, we constantly have to hear about why we need immigration and these things. You need these numbers to go up. You have to keep the entitlements flowing, this kind of thing. How did a regime that is kind of built on this idea of infinite growth also develop this ideology that basically dooms its population to not reproduce?
Yeah, it's really interesting. I think that they see that, you know, the middle class, the kind of traditional, you know, heritage American middle class is the main threat. You know, this is sort of like the Trump voter, center right, the people who are still religious, still kind of clinging to their guns and their religion, people who don't, just normies who don't want to see their children get kind of sucked into the gender maelstrom and cut their body parts off. You know, we still want to, you know, salute the American flag and not like the Progress Pride flag. So, you know, basically normie America is the threat. And so I think that they've just decided to go all in on shrinking that class as much as possible because of the electoral threat that it poses. And if they can just shrink it a little more and then bring in as many immigrants as possible while they still can, then they're kind of locked in forever. So it's a very short-term, short-sighted, obviously, strategy if you're thinking about what the heck they're up to. But I think that's it. And I mean, you know, people say, well, what they want is just like a giant surf class with a few elites at the top. And it feels like we're definitely going to be heading that way. That's what If you look at inflation and prices and just quality of life issues and the inability of young people to even dream about owning a home, and we are heading to a two-class society with no middle class, with just elites and serfs. And that's fine with them. And it does seem short-sighted because, yes, where is the growth? Where is that going to come from? And I don't know. It's obviously, to me, it's suicide for a nation to be heading to that direction. Growing the middle class is what made America great in the 20th century. That is what distinguished us from, you know, the rest of the world. And we can't, and that starts with a family. That starts with a mother and a father raising their children and like having their own family culture and going to church or whatever religious services every week and teaching their children to kind of be like them. And that's what makes you a good American. And that is, you know, not allowed anymore. It's basically illegal almost. It feels like here in Los Angeles, where they're banning, literally banning in my area, you know, the traditional Latin mass. You know, as we know, the FBI has already been, you know, putting the traditional Latin mass goers on like the FBI watch list, which is so funny because they're being thought of as domestic extremists, just like parents who speak out at a school board meeting being called, you know, domestic terrorists or whatever by Merrick Garland. And so that's the place we're in. And so my only response to that, and the reason I wrote the book, is to really give people, inspire people who feel like they're alone in a foxhole, that you're not alone. There are a lot of us out there and we're not going to go quietly.
I think it's really important that the event, the NatCon was the pronatalist event was the center of this this article, this hit piece, because Kevin Dolan, who's been a phylactery on Twitter, he's somebody I've had on the show multiple times, he put this on, and it I know they're asking a lot of questions around this, and I know you've addressed this as well. There seems to be a mixture of issues at play. Obviously, our government, our society, the way we have things structured right now is very anti-family. It is set up to hurt people who are trying to start families, to discourage people from involving themselves in the raising of their children, to make sure to separate the children from the authority of those parents as soon as they have them. Just everything about our social system right now seems to be set up against this. However, we've also seen governments around the world implement pro-family policies, and those don't always necessarily actually increase significantly the birth rate. And so I wonder if you could speak first to why you think the birth rate is falling. Is it just these policies? What policies are impacting young people that they can't have children? And if it's not just those policies, what other cultural, social, spiritual factors do you think are driving down the desire of people to have children or the ability to have children?
The natal conference that you're talking about, that was back in December in Austin. And I spoke at it along with a lot of people. There was a couple of, you know, trads like me. And then there were sort of geneticists and people who were kind of delving into the science of population decline. It was really interesting. It wasn't extremist, like at all. It was really funny to read that article. I think that having children has just become just this sort of thing that for a young woman, and I think this is really where it starts with feminism, which is what also my book tackles, is just this is feminism reaping what they've sown and teaching young women, young girls. I mean, I was taught this from age, you know, 10, 11, that the highest, the best thing you can do with your life and what you actually need to do to really find yourself and to kind of self-actualize as a person is to avoid at all costs, you can do whatever you need to do, avoid pregnancy, avoid marriage until you have your career established, because that is how you express your true value as a human being and as a person, okay? And so young girls are put on the birth control pill quite young. I remember, you know, they would give it out at my sex ed class in like middle school, and in college, it was basically free. And you know, the Planned Parenthood messaging, which is all about, you know, exploring sexuality and don't settle down, have as many partners as you want, and just kind of all the guardrails that we're used to for young people, removed, right? The Sex in the City lifestyle, you know, I'm Gen X, that's what we grew up kind of aspiring to. But when you look at it, it's like actually quite dark, that lifestyle, just along, you know, and I think now with Tinder, you know, women are on that app. I wrote about this. There's women who got on Tinder the day it launched in the App Store, and 10 years later still on Tinder. And I mean, if that's not like a cautionary tale, I don't know what is. So I think that, you know, girl boss, girl power, that has just taught young women that anything that takes you outside that track, like staying home with your baby, you know, for a year or for 2 years or whatever, is like shocking taboo. And I've experienced this so many times with young women who I worked with when I was a head of corporate writing career. They would have their baby and there was just not even a, no one even would suggest to them, maybe you should like, maybe it'd be great for you to stay home with your baby if you want to nurse it and until it's old enough to go to school. I mean, even just to say that to someone would have gotten you fired, blackballed as like a crazy woman hater. You want to ruin her life. You want to ruin her career. I'm like, well, no, I'm thinking about what actually you want as a woman. You don't want to leave your baby. It's the most natural, normal thing in the world. The maternal instinct is very powerful and you just have this overwhelming instinct to be with that infant, physically close to that infant as much as possible every day, like as long as you can. I mean, that was what I experienced and that's why I didn't go back to work in an office after I had my first child. except for, I did for a few years when my oldest was in preschool at the time, then I had a fifth baby and that was it. I was done forever. I was never going back, but I would see young women come back from maternity leave. And they would, I'd be like, well, where's your baby? And they're 6 week old. And they're like, oh, well, he's in school. I dropped him off at school, you know? And it's like, they would show me pictures of like literally a 6 week old newborn at a daycare. And I just, you know, I can't, like, to me, it's like so traumatic to think about that baby being without the mother and the mother without the baby. And they would talk themselves into this as being normal and okay. And everyone agreed, this is normal. This is okay. This is just what you do. This is what you do. And so for me to say, I'm not coming back. I want to nurse my baby. I nursed her for 2 years, my last baby. I couldn't quit her. That was abnormal. And that was like kind of shocking. And people would say, well, you're giving up. You're, you know, I was making six-figure salary and all incredible benefits, all these perks. And like, how can you give this up? But to me, yeah, it was a huge sacrifice, financial sacrifice, but like, it wasn't a debate. Like I couldn't, it would have been like cutting off my arm. You know what I mean? But women have been kind of talked out of that. They have been kind of mind flayed to not even allow themselves to remember what the maternal instinct is there for, what the purpose of that mother-child bond is, because your career is the only thing that matters. And I think that and we see this over and over again in even third world countries that traditionally had very high birth rates, as you introduce birth control and abortion to those countries, and careerism and feminism, the birth rates plummet. And so now we're seeing countries all throughout South America and Asia obviously having incredibly low birth rates. I'm not saying women need 8, 9, 10 kids. That's not at all what I'm saying. I'm saying, you know, to beat the replacement rate, which is like 2.1. Okay, so like 3 kids takes care of it. But even that is completely out of reach to women who want, who decide they're going to work instead.
So obviously there's this social pressure, right? And that's a massive component. Like you said, the way that, you know, women are told where their value comes from and how they need to approach dating and marriage and all of these things. But to be fair, for a lot of people who do want children, there is a financial barrier. Right. And like you said, it, of course, for you, it's, you know, it was a financial sacrifice, but I would imagine you probably had a husband who was able to still be able to take care of you. And so there's a situation that is also a lot of people are in where they're reliant on these dual incomes. We've inflated our economy to the point where it's impossible. You know, you look back to TV shows from the 70s and the 80s and a guy with, you know, 4 kids and a wife who stays home is like a shoe salesman. And I know TV isn't real life, but that was something that was relatable. You know, you're like a manager at a hardware store. Of course you can afford a home with multiple children and a stay-at-home wife. Yeah. And today that seems impossible for a lot of people. So, you know, obviously the social impact is massive and all the things that you just discussed, but there is, to be fair, a economic issue and a way we structure our society that is a big problem. And I think that for the most part, conservatives, Republicans, the GOP, they've been in on this, right? Like they have been involved in creating the economy and the social situation. They talk about family values. You know, you get people talking about the importance of family values, but they don't promote anything that actually would create the ability to people have families. So can you speak a little bit about the structural and economic problems that come from both the left and right that keep people who do want to have children from having them?
Yeah, I mean, this is the major issue that you keep running into, the wall. Like, have more kids, but I mean, how can I? I can't afford it. And I actually do address this in my book. Whenever I pitch an idea, for example, something like, if you have three or more kids, you don't pay income tax. Or if you have three or more kids, you get, you know, 0% mortgage or something. Something that will give people the incentive or the ability even to have an additional child or even to have like their first child. Republicans accuse me of being a socialist. They come out and say, people have to work. I mean, we didn't get that. Like, no, it's a different world now. You know, the boomers had it all. People now need help. And when I look at the economy and inflation and the housing crunch and all of this and what it does to people and how it does actually turns them into dinks, you know, double income, no kids, out of financial necessity. We can't even have this lifestyle. If we introduce children into it, we'll be poor, you know? I totally understand that. And it does make me think that there is something purposeful about what they've done to tear down the economy, how they outsourced all the jobs in the Midwest and the Rust Belt to China, you know, starting in the 70s and 80s, and the GOP was 100% in on that, outsourcing all of our manufacturing, outsourcing, you know, the car industry, all of it, pharmaceutical. And so you have people who had, let's say, mining jobs in West Virginia or whatever. Those are gone, thanks to, you know, the climate fanatics. And so you have people who were able, like you said, Ed Bundy could raise a child on a kind of a basic income. And now that's just totally impossible. And even two incomes, you're barely going to make it. Especially if you live in a city. And it does feel like that's purposeful. It feels like that's intentional. It feels like they want to make it literally actually impossible to get married, buy a little starter house somewhere and have a couple of kids. That little tiny version of the American dream is almost out of reach for, you know, college graduates. Like, how can you even do that anymore? They're not hiring, you know, white men aren't getting into college. They're not even getting a college degree. White men can't even get a job. You know, like there's just the DEI rules shut them out even of taking part in the economy or college. So it's purposeful. And yes, I totally understand. And telling someone, you have to stay home with your baby. Don't put that baby in daycare. Well, how can you do that when they're like, well, we can't pay the rent. So we have an absolutely structural problem that has to be solved if we want to solve the birth rate. Elon Musk has talked about this. Tucker Carlson has talked about this. Elizabeth Warren, before she, you know, went native, talked about the two-income trap. It's an obvious problem. There's an easy solution, which is the short term. Give young couples a huge financial incentive. Take, you know, whatever, however you want to do it. I don't know. I'm not an economist, right? I'm nothing with math. Figure that out. Make all that stuff free for them somehow. And then in the long term, we have to make this country livable again, which it basically isn't anymore.
Well, I think a big part of that is also your, you know, just the mass immigration and the obsession with bringing lots of people in that are going to change the country, but more importantly, for what we're talking about, change the economy, right? Like, you have homes become extremely expensive because of the pressure of people moving in, the cost of labor plummets, making it difficult for people to make an income, you know, the competition for housing creates inflation that blows all of this out of proportion, daycares, all the key, you know, it's my favorite trick that economists do is they're like, oh, the inflation's fine if you just cut out housing and gas and food and childcare and medical care,
right.
You know, all the things you would need to say, have children and a family and live basically, you know, TVs are cheaper. There's not a lot of inflation in TVs. So that's great. But all those other things matter. And so the fact that, you know, people are constantly having to compete for limited, you know, jobs and resources against basically the entire world, I think, is a huge issue. And I also wanted to talk to you a little bit about what you think about kind of the role that religion and identity play in this, because, you know, identity politics is a very dirty word, right? Especially the right, you know, hates it, of course. But there is and to be clear, obviously, like, the exploitation, especially when we're talking about these interchangeable identities that the left are creating, are quite terrible. But there is something about the fact that people have lost a sense of community and identity that is, I think, very, very critical to the way that people have lost the motivation to have children, because when you were bound up in a community, when you had, I think, the idea of an extended family that helped you to raise a child. It wasn't just, you know, the mom at home staying at home every day, but it was, you know, you're plugged in to grandparents and aunts and uncles. There's a community aspect that you can bring your children to, and you can involve yourselves in things that are to contribute to the community. You're not just isolated in your home alone. I think that made a big difference, and people cared more about perpetuating their family when it was part of a long line, a tradition they could identify. Oh, my parents were here, and they cared about this place. And, you know, my religion will be carried on through them. And these are all things that I think are give people the idea that they are involved in a continuity of being that matters and is more organic and is much more important than, you know, and the economic sacrifices don't seem as big when you value those things more, I think. And I just wonder what you thought about the role that those factors, religion and community, play in, I guess, impacting current birth rates.
That's just a beautiful way to put it. I got really lucky because I found my way to sort of a community that I had never been part of before, which is a community of sort of modern day trad moms. I don't know how else to describe them. These are Catholic women. And I mean, like real Catholics, like devout pro-life Catholics, who were having children, and they were just having kind of, you know, one said to me once, I asked her before I converted, I was like, she was pregnant with like her sixth or seventh child. I was like, well, how many are you going to have? And she was just like, well, as many as God wants me to, you know? And I was like, well, like I had never encountered that kind of spirit, that kind of attitude towards having children. And I started hanging around with them, and they're like completely normal, cool, fun, like, look normal. You can't tell when you're with them that they're like weird, you know, fanatics or weirdos. They're just normal. They fit in, right? Like they're walking around like regular people. But at home, they were having child after child. They have, you know, I have five. So I'm actually something of a lightweight. there's plenty with like, you know, four and three and stuff, but there's a lot. I have friends who have 10 kids. I have friends who have 12 kids. And they're completely great and beautiful families. Everyone's together. You know, they're just incredible examples. And so, yeah, so that community that I kind of started belonging to when I converted did inspire me. And it absolutely did make me think I could have another child. You know, maybe I'm not going to stop at four. It was okay. If they can do it, it's normal. I can do it. I think peer pressure also, when you're in a community, you're seeing what everyone else is doing and capable of doing. And you think, oh, maybe I could do that, you know, and survive and raise wonderful, devout children myself. And so that was like super inspiring, and people don't have that. And that's where religion, I think, comes in. Obviously, I don't think I could do this if I hadn't converted, if I had still been what I was, which was basically a completely secular atheist who didn't believe in anything. That would have not, it really doesn't give you a kind of higher purpose or calling, you know, and a parenthood at the end of the day, whether you're atheist or religious, is a sacrificial devotion. Because if you want to be a good parent, there's enormous sacrifices. I don't care if you're rich or poor, you are sacrificing so much of your time and your energy and your effort and, yes, your money and all those things for a lifetime. You're locked into it. And so I think thinking about it in those terms as like a sacrifice, as a devotion, it does seem to mitigate a lot of the kind of daily, you know, pains of having kids. And there's a lot of pains. There's mess and all the other stuff. Thinking about it as giving back to some kind of thing bigger than you, like you're saying with your ancestors and roots and community. I mean, yes, connecting like my great grandmother who came to this country as like a refugee from the Russian Empire in like the, you know, in 1906 or something on a boat alone, and connecting her to my children and thinking what she did is paying off, you know, her incredible sacrifice, you know, one day, like if she only knew that she was going to end up having, you know, so many great grandchildren, how beautiful that is. And it's something that immigrants, illegal immigrants coming through the border, they have no connection. They have no connection to our land, to our country, to our history, to our, you know, where our ancestors are from. I mean, they have their own in their homes, I'm sure, some long history there, but they don't have a connection, and they don't have a reason to put down roots and really fully engage in the kind of American project, which is what all of our immigrant parents did. They were just like, threw off whatever, you know, whatever country they came from, they threw that off and they just kind of dove into like Americanism, for lack of a better word. And we have so many new people coming in, like that's not really going to happen. That's not, it's going to be kind of like they're physically here, but are they here in their hearts and their minds? I mean, I have no idea. And it does degrade the other communities who have to struggle, like you said, struggle more for resources and where they're going to live. But I think, yes, the key really is for me, if you want to become a domestic extremist like me, try to find a community. And a lot of people can find them. I mean, I've found so many friends online, as you know. I've found people on Twitter or on X that are now my real life friends who are kind of scattered around the world, trying to build their own little communities and trying to raise families. And we're trying to do this in the teeth of like such hostility and like almost such pure hatred. And I mean, that, you know, calling us far right in Politico is just an example of that. And I have libertarians calling me like this wacky, you know, wacky trad mom. And I'm like, there's nothing wacky about this. This is life and death. This is like existential. If we want humanity, if we want this country to see the next century, we're going to have to make more people like me and like you who understand the importance of this project that we're engaged in. I mean, it really is life and death.
So one of the things that Politico, again, got very angry with you about was talking about, you know, we're done with trying to, you know, the way they framed it was they're done trying to convince people. So they're just going to have kids. We'll just have enough kids. And you won't have kids, and we'll outbreed you, and then our kids vote, and you'll be done for. And right. You know, it's funny that they took so much offense at this, of course, which is hilarious because that's their entire plan, right? Like literally, every day they're like, "We're going to replace all the people in America with new people, and those people will vote for us." That's what they announced on a regular. And then they get angry if you point it out. Tucker Carlson, hey, you know how they keep saying this live on television, and they're like, "Whoa, whoa, whoa, conspiracy theory." You know, their literal plan is we're going to shift the demographics of this country and change the way people vote. And you're just like, well, no, that's my plan, but I'm just going to do it with my own children instead of importing people. But I will say this. So there's been a big debate over this issue. A lot of people get very angry when people bring up the just have kids program. Yeah. And I'll say this. It is necessary, but not sufficient. Right. That's the thing. But they will say, this is usually their argument, is, look, you can have all the kids you want, but the regime owns the media, the regime owns the educational institutions, the regime has all of the consensus-making apparatus, and they're just going to take your kids and turn them into cannon fodder, right? They're just going to brainwash them, and yeah, you had kids, good for you, but they're not going to carry your values forward. And to be fair, when you look at the immigrants that are supposed to come in and replenish our population, that is actually what happens. You know, the joke I always make is, you know, you don't have to worry about Sharia law, that they will turn the Muslim kids trans before the Muslim kids will turn your kids halal. And so what is the counter to this? How do you avoid this? Yes, you're having the families, you're bringing the kids up in the way they should go, but eventually they enter into that world and now it's completely controlled by hostile forces. What is the answer to this question?
Yeah, I mean, if you're not careful, your children will get sucked out of your family values, whatever you're trying to instill in them, and they'll get sucked right into what the regime wants to implant in their brain. And it's real. And I've seen this, you know, I have friends who do they're on the right, you know, they're conservative, but there's kind of nothing underpinning that. And their children go to, let's say, a fancy private school or just the public school down the street. And they are kind of shocked when the kid comes home and says that, you know, mommy, I don't know if I'm a girl. You know, they're surprised. They're crying because climate change is going to make the earth burn up in 5 years and we have to throw away our oven or get rid of our washing machine or whatever it is. And so I tell people this all the time and I write about this all the time. My children, though, okay, are marked safe from all of that stuff. My children are not going to, you know, pro-Palestine rallies and like tearing down buildings and their schools. My children are somehow here in Los Angeles, in California, are pro-life, devout Catholics who are chaste and are hoping to get married early in their 20s and produce grandchildren for me and my husband. So accomplish this. Okay, look, nothing's perfect. There's no guarantees. Okay, you can't guarantee in life that that is what will happen. But I think I have a very good chance of getting all or at least most of them through the gauntlet, through the minefield. And really it comes down to very simple things. You have to avoid putting them in public school. Now, I have friends in, let's say, in Tennessee, outside Nashville, the public elementaries and the high schools are actually fine. You know, they don't do pride flags. They don't do pronouns. That's fine. Okay, fine. But if you live in a blue city, if you live in a blue state, you have to be very careful. You know, Austin public schools, I don't know, like you're in Texas, but I think Austin's a little bit, you know, a little bit wacky. And then if you also can get them to, you know, the cheat codes for us, really, we're raising them Catholic. My husband and I converted, but the children are now really cradle Catholics. And I mean, talk about, you know, very, you know, instant brainwashing. The Catholic Church, we find a good parish, a priest who is actually like based, for lack of a better word, your children will be immunized. It'll happen kind of without you even doing too much like counter-programming for them. And then you have to also just make sure that they're not, you know, looking at porn on their phones when they're little boys. Most boys access pornography on their cell phones. Majority of boys by like age 11 or 12. And so you have to teach them why to avoid these things. And the why is because it's really bad for you. And here's the reasons why. And it's also a sin. And it's all these things. As you kind of scare them straight, and then all their friends are on the same program as yours. And so you really kind of, I mean, it's really amazing. It's almost like a miracle. I don't have to worry about my kids, you know, doing fentanyl in high school and like dying of an overdose. I don't have to worry about, you know, one of my sons like getting someone pregnant. Like that's just literally not happening. And people scoff when I say this and they say, come on, they're all doing it. I'm like, actually, no, they're not. They're not all doing it. There are places and schools that you can find and communities where the majority of the children, and I mean the vast majority, if not all, like are adopting our program. Like the political writer, she was horrified that we were talking about having our children that would look like us, you know, having your own biological children that look like us is bad. But I think what she meant was children that would adopt the same lifestyle, adopt the same kind of Catholic trad lifestyle. That was bad. And it was really telling that she said that because they want your children. They literally do. They literally do need to separate your children from you, the weird extremist trad, to get your child on their program. So they are not reproducing. They're not baby maxing. They're married to the state. They're married to Tinder. And, you know, they're self-actualizing through a career or whatever it is. They're exploring their sexuality till they're dead alone. They are terrified at that. And if you can get on, you know, the lifestyle that I've been doing with great success so far, and a lot of people I know, and we're, you know, they're kind of like this hidden, you know, fringe religious cult. Some people think, you know, but we're just Catholics. We're just doing like a Catholic life that is completely normal, or was a few years ago, pre-Pope Francis. And if you can pull this off, I mean, if you can teach a child that, like a young child, like what a pregnancy means and what an unborn baby actually is and what abortion therefore must be and how mean that is for a mommy to do that to a baby. If you have a child who thinks that, who understands that truth, it's very unlikely that that child will ever grow up one day and go to like a, you know, an abortion rally covered in, you know, fake blood screaming for abortions. And that girl just won't do that. And so there are these ways you can do it. There is a way to kind of immunize your kids. And so, you know, wish me luck, fingers crossed. We've done it.
Yeah. I think that you're right that the state, obviously, again, when they need to have that malleability, they need, because they are, you know, obviously in a situation where they're not having a lot of kids, it's designed not to have kids. They need to be able to break down any barriers, any alternatives that you would create. And especially because they don't want your weird, crazy, extremist lifestyle to seem actually pretty healthy and normal and desirous. And so it needs to go away. And the key to create that really is those alternative institutions that you're talking about. You know, if you look at, you know, Jewish or Catholic immigrants to the United States, they created their own schools immediately, right? These are famously their schools. Why? Well, because they knew that the public schools in, you know, in America, well, they weren't hostile the way they are now. They were Protestant, right? They were inherently Protestant. And so if they wanted to keep their culture separate and different, if they wanted to keep them distinct and keep their values from being kind of just absorbed into the American culture, they needed to create alternative institutions. Well, whether we like it or not now, like, traditional Christians are in a situation where they have to protect their culture from the majority culture. And so the way to do that is to create those same alternative institutions. Don't let your enemies raise your children. And like you said, very importantly, having those communities, especially conservatives, unfortunately, are just so big on the individual freedom, right? And the atomization. And they don't think about what it takes beyond just, well, make sure to raise your kids right. Well, that's good. But then they have to have friends and they have to get married and they have to interact with people. And the larger you can create this sphere of alternative institutions and community, the more can be included inside of it. So if it's just you and a couple friends, well, maybe you can do some homeschooling and you can do some alternative things, but there's only so much you can do. But if you can build that wider and wider and wider, you can start including businesses, you can start including libraries, you can start including all kinds of things that are funded and created by your community. Well, now more and more things can be done inside that system where you don't have to go outside of it and create a situation where the kid's going to lose their values. And of course, eventually they will have to go out into the world, but they will have a much stronger background. Like you said, they will have all of their background will be linked to that faith and that community. And they will have a much higher percentage chance of kind of going and entering into the normal world, but still retaining the values that made them who they are. So the last thing I wanted to talk to you about before we go to some of the questions from the audience is, you just released a piece yesterday, and I saw your tweet first, and then I kind of saw the Substack that you had written about it later. But obviously the campus protests are happening right now. And they're kind of the biggest story in the news. We have the pro Palestinian and pro Israeli kind of clash. It's in many ways an inter leftist civil war going on, where establishment left kind of nominally supports Israel because they have to, their donor base and stuff. But they don't, you know, they kind of wish they could be with the radical leftist vanguard, and they're the ones that are actually pushing these things. And you put out a tweet saying, you know, look, where were you guys? Like, you're like, I'm glad, you know, yes, that you should be protecting Jewish students from violence, but where were you people when they were threatening white kids? Where were you when they were anti-white and they were having these seminars on destroying whiteness and teaching classes and writing books? Where was this now? Because there's, you know, there's this backlash against what's happening. And as you pointed out in your piece, well-deserved, because, you know, you pointed out you are a Catholic convert, but you are, you know, genetically Jewish. You have Jewish parents and such. So
I'm part Jewish, yeah.
Right. And so this is a situation where it's like, okay, you know, obviously you care about people being protected from violence, and you want people to be able to, you know, have their identity and not have that, but also recognizing that this is something that basically the right and just wider society abandoned for a very long time and suddenly has found the courage to stand up against. It seems only because a very particular group suddenly has like this right to exist when they were attacking a whole other subset for a decade or more. And no one seemed to be able to gather action to it.
Yeah, I think the article you're referring to, I wrote for my Substack called Meet the Zoomerwaffen.
Yeah.
I'm calling the Gen Z protesters the Zoomerwaffen, the Jew-hating college kids on our elite campuses. And I wrote that for my Substack, peachykeenan.substack.com, in which I revealed that, yes, I am part Jewish. My mother is 100% Ashkenazi Jewish. I was raised secular atheist. I converted to Catholicism. So my kids like know, you know, they're kind of like a mix of Anglo, Irish, Scottish, and Eastern European Jewishness or whatever, but they don't identify like racially as anything but just white kids, right? So my sons are now facing a world that is kind of arrayed against them as like straight white, you know, heteronormative males. And they understand, because I have told them, you're at a huge disadvantage. We just actually saw this when my son, who's a senior in high school, he applied to college, right? We just finished our entire college process. And I knew going in, and it, you know, we were faced with the like, you know, ethnic checkboxes for all the colleges. And people on Twitter were like, make sure he checks Black and Hispanic and check everything, you know? And he, I was like, I said, do you want, what should we do? I mean, if you just say white, you know, you probably won't get in. And he was like, Mom, I can't lie. you know, he refused to even like consider any of that. So we checked like Italian and like a few other options that made him like a little more med, like something, because we are part Italian. And lo and behold, he got completely shut out of all the University of California schools, UCLA, Berkeley, UC San Diego, and USC. And his scores and grades and everything were top notch. And of course, these schools let in a very narrow percentage of, you know, straight white males into their undergraduate freshman class. But it was just really interesting to see that actually happen in real time. That, oh, in fact, there is, could there be a bias racially against people like him? So they identify as white. So I wrote the article in defense of you know, like white people who are saying, yes, we don't want, anti-Semitism is bad. You know, we do not want any hate speech against Jews or Jewish students to feel uncomfortable on campus, or, you know, not allowed to walk into a certain dorm room, or to be called, you know, genociders and colonizers, like, and to, for them to be cheering the deaths of Jews in Israel who are raped and mutilated and, you know, massacred. We, of course, we condemn all of that. But hello, that's been going on generally for white people, especially straight white males on college campuses for decades. And my children are about to start college and experience this for themselves, potentially, if they choose, if they make the mistake of going to one of these elite universities, which I hope they don't. And so that was my defense, that that's all fine and good. You want to do special protections for Jewish kids? That's fine, but that's not fair. That's not fair, because then it still leaves the kind of like, you know, the non-Jewish guys, the Gentiles, still the number one approved villain in the elite universities and in Hollywood and in basically in media. You're still allowed to hate on the regular white guy, right? He's a bad guy, and that will never change. And we can protect all these groups have their special carve out. Jewish kids after October 7th were suddenly felt like they lost their carve out. They lost their kind of protected minority status, and they're kind of trying to reclaim it. And John Podoretz, you know, the commentary editor, he's my nemesis, I guess. I really didn't really know much about him. He hates me. He put out a tweet and said, wait, hold on. You can't do this. Jews are not white. Jews are not white. They deserve minority protection under the DEI regime. But the leftists are like, no, Jews are white. They're white enough for us. Israelis are white enough for us. They're colonizers and, you know, genociders of the, you know, the browner people. And it's like this weird thing that happened with Jews, liberal Jews, trying to kind of reclaim their status as oppressed minorities, and the left rejecting that and saying, nope, colonizers. Not only are you the bad white guys, you're like the worst white people of all. And I think that's what we're seeing playing out. It's really kind of extraordinary. So my article was just me, you know, pointing out, like, you can't have special protections for this group and not this group. No one should ever be subjected to hate speech and getting barred from speaking out or whatever it is, or the same rights that, you know, and we need to return to a meritocracy in the justice system, in college admissions, all of it. You know, race blindness worked for a long time. And so that was my attempt to kind of bring some sanity to the issue.
Yeah, I would mostly agree, though. I would say that hate speech is a word that is, I would use.
Yeah, that's their language.
Yeah, well, and importantly, because it's, you know, the way that triggers a lot of even lawfare at this point, you know, I want people to be able to criticize Israel. I want people to be able to criticize, you know, whoever they want. I want people to be safe, right? I don't want anyone to face any kind of, you know, physical violence because of their race. And while I don't think personally people should have racial animus, that's not illegal. That's not, and nor should it be. I don't think that, you know, anti-white or anti-Jewish rhetoric have should be funded by the state. I don't think there's any need for that to be taught at any of these places. But obviously, protesters have the right to go ahead and kind of make those statements as they like, as long as they're doing so peacefully. The problem is when, obviously, in many cases it's not peaceful, and that's a huge issue. One thing you did also mention that I wanted to pick your brain a little bit on is you said that you think that this could shift some of kind of the liberal Jewish constituency. Like you said in the piece, it is a massive, you know, it's not as monolithic as kind of the black vote for the Democratic Party, but it's even more monolithic than the Hispanic vote for, you know, it actually is more organized in the direction of the Democratic Party as a vote. And I wonder if you think that will actually shift. You know, we're often told that the big shift is coming, right? Like Black America is going to start voting for Trump, and it's, you know, it's only a matter of time. And you would think, like, logically, it makes sense. Like, what you're saying is, you know, makes sense. But then I look at kind of the Horowitz, at, you know, approach. It's like, I don't know, because it feel like that unprincipled exception to the leftist rhetoric around colonization and everything allowed, like you said, leftist Jews to kind of exist in the safety pocket. They didn't sink to the bottom of the oppression hierarchy like you would expect from kind of the way that that narrative is laid out. But that is crumbling. So the logic around that pocket of protection is falling apart. But still, it feels like many of these guys, like Podhoretz, feel like the protection is still for them on the left. Like, that is still the safe place to be. You know, Bill Ackman and such kind of made noises about how they're going to fight the left, but then he immediately turns around and dumps millions of dollars into Democratic candidates. Right. And I just wonder if there really is a significant sea change that could happen with kind of this shift, obviously, in the rhetoric that is now including Jews in that, you know, colonizer white storyline.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. And there's also Jewish kids in the pro-Palestinian camps at these schools. So right. it's really interesting. I mean, I can just, you know, I don't know the numbers on this, but I can just speak from just experience. I grew up in West LA, so I still have friends and friends of friends who are, you know, they're private school Jewish kids who are now adults, who have families. And I will say that the trans stuff kind of primed the ground for them to kind of go like, whoa, this is, I don't actually want like my child becoming transgender. Like, I'll draw the line, like, at the private school pushing this. That's kind of too far for me. So that, I think, has primed them a little bit for the first time to question their loyalties to the Democratic Party. And these are people who were all in for Obama, Hollywood people who were, you know, giving all the fundraisers in Malibu for Kamala and Biden, you know, in 2020. And they were all in Trump, orange man bad, right? And now, after October 7th, I was hearing a lot of them say, we think we need to vote for Trump. He protected Israel. He is the only one who like spoke out for Israel. So, and there's even some who say like Israel is their only issue, which is, you know, a common statement among liberal blue state Jews. Israel is their number one issue. Okay, not mine. Mine is immigration and crime and the economy, okay? But for a lot of them, it is the number one issue. And so when they see that what's going on, and they see, you know, AOC and Ilhan Omar making nice to people who they think perceive as hate them and hate Jews are true anti-Semites, I think it does shift them. And some of them have come out and said they're not going to vote for Biden. I don't know if they'll vote for Trump, but they're not going to vote for Biden. Is it enough? I mean, here in California, it doesn't matter. We're so outnumbered that it really won't make a difference. Could it make a difference in some of the other kind of purple states? I don't know, Virginia, in the Midwest. I mean, New York is very interesting to me. New York came close to Zeldin and has kind of sort of seemed to be going purple in some of the areas. The Orthodox Jewish community, obviously, there is pretty big in Brooklyn. It's a very interesting state to watch. Can Trump win New York because of disaffected liberal Jews? Like, I don't think so in the end, but we'll see what happens. It's very interesting.
All right, guys. Well, we're going to go ahead and switch over to the questions of the people. But before we do, PG, can you remind people where to find your book and all of your other work?
Sure. You can follow me on X at Keenan Peachy, and also subscribe to my Substack, peachykeenan.substack.com. My book, Domestic Extremist, is on sale at Amazon.
Excellent, guys. Make sure that you check out her work. The American Mind piece was particularly good here recently. All right. So we've got Creeper Weirdo here. He says, isn't this an upside down world where anti-natalists are all over the internet? Hang on, guys. This idea is interesting. Pro-natalists are the terrorists. Yeah, there is obviously this very strange moment where just a traditional life does seem threatening to, you know, the people in charge. But unfortunately, that is kind of where we're at. Creeper Weirdo also says, but Ms. Keenan, don't you want to buy purses? Yeah, there really is that argument. Yeah. Well,
yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I do.
Yeah.
I would love to be able to, you know, go to Neiman Marcus and drop, you know, whatever, $5,000 on like a Celine purse. Like, sure. Maybe one day I'll be able to do that. But like I said, it's a sacrificial devotion. And, you know, I feel like you can have to choose what you're rich in. And I feel like I'm rich in children and potential grandchildren. So no purse, no fancy purses yet.
I mean, like you said, it is a sacrificial act, and people should go, mm-hmm. should go into it with that, you know, eyes open, you know, like, exactly. I think that is something. It doesn't do anyone any favors by lying to them about that fact. So,
true.
But worth it, as you would say. So Florida Henry says, greetings from Dakota Badlands. Again, this goes back to Reaganomics. I make $150K a year with a house, and the only way I see having a family is moving overseas. Yeah, I mean, obviously, we could have a lot of debates over when and how the economic system that we have now is kind of developed. I have a theory that we didn't dive into, but I think you know, there's a thinker, Oswald Spengler, who said that really once people start having to decide whether or not to have children, when having children is not part of just the natural rhythm of life that occurs in your society, that's where it naturally starts to decline. That's when you will yeah. see this. And even if you take steps to increase the number of children, people, just because they have to make that choice as opposed to just running into this as just part of the development, it will necessarily kind of reduce your number. And in some ways you start to think that modernity itself is kind of the great filter, that mm-hmm. as you said, when, you know, all these other groups make contact, you know, even outside the United States, outside of the West, with many of the modern technologies and ways of life, it does seem to impact their fertility rates, no matter what people do, to some extent.
Yeah, that's so interesting. I definitely agree with you. I think that when you're on the pill, having to go off the pill is a very hard decision. It's a very, you have to make this affirmative decision to go off the pill or have an IUD removed. You can't just have a whoops, I'm pregnant moment. And that affirmative decision to do that is scary, because then you're like, well, do we have enough money? Are we ready? And the real answer is no, you don't have enough money and you're never going to be ready. But that surprise baby is the motivation sometimes that you need to get ready. At least it was in my case.
Yeah, there's the Mary Harrington talked about this in her book about the pill shifting the default idea of women being fertile to an off switch, right? Like you, yeah. instead of that being right. the default, now it's no, you have to turn it on to be fertile. And that was a big shift in the mindset and the way that families form. Creeper Weirdo, who again says, Sam Hyde said something interesting about this. How do I make my child based? Give them earnest love and affection. And that's a crazy internet funny man. It's such strange times we live in, guys. Well, I'll say this. I mean, obviously, your parents' attention is going to be a massive impact on a child. The adult attention really is just kind of a magic thing for many children in their development. And, you know, being intentional and putting that time in matters, of course. But it does matter what you're putting the time in towards, right? And that's where I think that community, that wider religiosity, that idea that you're connected to a tradition and a community matters, because, you know, you could have a parent that does spend a lot of time their child and attention, and that's still going to bring the child, I think, a better life, but it won't necessarily make them based, as many people would say. It does matter what you're putting in at the end of the day.
Right. And I think that being in close proximity, physical proximity to your newborn for as long as possible has been proven to mitigate a lot of bad side effects that children who are separated early do experience, behavioral problems and other things. It's just kind of like a severing of the maternal bond. So the stronger you can keep it and form it at first with that young baby, that kind of powers you through the teenage years, which are a little bit, it's a little bit harder. They get a little harder to love. Let me put it that way.
Perspicacious Heretic says, there's a lot of argument over women in this space. What should the typical woman sympathetic to this worldview be doing to advance this cause? Yeah, that's a good question. There was quite a bit of dialogue about the woman question, as it's often called, on Twitter. What do you think is the best role, or you know, what do you see? Obviously, you're someone who's, you know, speaking in kind of many of these spheres. How would you answer that question?
Yeah, women are would rather be lost in the woods with a bear than a man. Like, not me, although maybe it depends on the man. I don't know. Don't want to be locked in the woods with John Potteris. That's all I know.
Yeah, that's
true. there's an issue. There's women and men kind of at each other's throats, even on the right. Women are becoming more liberal. Young men are becoming more conservative. How do we get them together? How do we get them to procreate? Like, it's this impossible dynamic. But I will say that, like, if you make it a priority like you really do want to get married. You really do want to like find love and have a baby before you're, you know, in your 40s, let's say. If you make it the priority, I think you can do it. And I think that part of that is for young men, like becoming marriageable. Don't look at porn, don't smoke weed, like become a responsible, you know, looks maxing guy, like do what you can, you know, to increase your odds. And for women, I mean, the same thing, like don't, you know, don't get off the, you know, antidepressants, try to pull yourself together, make yourself also more marriageable and more attractive. And that is like, you know, you're not allowed to say these things. Like you, if I say this in other company, I will get, you know, things thrown at me when I suggest these things to women. But also I think the pill, back to the pill actually decreases your libido, and it's been proven to actually make women more asexual and not even attracted to masculine men. And some women, I read a study that some, they say that the pill can actually make women, straight women, lesbians, because it just messes with your hormones in so many ways. So I would say that, you know, men find a girl who's not on the pill, and women find it just a nice guy.
This all goes back to Alex Jones being right about the chemicals making the frogs go in the water, doesn't it?
Exactly.
Paladin YYZ says, born of Norwegian Lutherans, I was adopted by a Catholic couple. My Catholicism guarded me from succumbing to prog metal and pagan crap. I naturally love Sabbath, Priest, Led Zeppelin, you know, good Catholic metal. Look, there is a lot of good Christian metal out there, guys. You don't have to listen to black metal or satanic metal. There's lots of very good Christian metal. You can listen to War of Ages. You can listen to Stryper. You can listen to all kinds of other, you know, kind of deathcore bands that are in the Christian metal sphere. You can listen to all kinds of good stuff out there. You don't have to fall into, and by the way, Rab Halford, I believe, has converted to Christianity from Judas Priest. So a lot of guys like Alice Cooper and these guys, like they realize like, you're not going to make it, man. You can't survive the rock star lifestyle, ironically, as an atheist. It just doesn't work long term. So
I didn't know you were into metal.
I have got the albums behind me for a reason here. Yeah.
Very cool.
So let's see here. We've got Marcos 588 says, how do we trust former liberal progressives if they can't forego the belief and presumptions that brought them here, if they just enshrine the Buckley effect of skewing, derailing the right wing leftward? Yeah, I've obviously written a lot about this. This is something that I've talked about in my pieces like the Neocon cycle. This is a real danger that the right needs to guard itself against. There's a constant revolving door of, I didn't leave the left left me, guys coming in and then immediately demanding that the right wing become more accommodating to all their left wing positions, except like trans kids or something. They pick like one thing and then otherwise they're still leftists, and you know, they want the right to kind of conform to this. The key thing, guys, I think is always about people who really see that there was something wrong with their prior belief system. You know, the people who say, the left didn't just get too crazy for me, but I actually saw a real problem in the priors that I held, a fundamental issue in the worldview and the values that I had. Often this does come with a religious conversion. Many an atheist has become a Christian and realized that that also shifts their politics. And so I think when you see someone who is repentant in a religious sense, but even in a political sense, of says, hey, I held these positions, but I understand that it wasn't just that the people on my side went too far, but that there was a real problem with kind of the axioms on which my worldview is based. That's when I think it's then you can see somebody who really is coming along and changing their thing. But otherwise, you do need to be careful. Fine for people to come into the tent if you see that the left's going crazy. Just don't put them in leadership immediately. You know, make them sit around and learn a little bit before they immediately jump into positions of leadership.
Right.
Let's see here. And then we have, Robert Weitzfeld said, right-winged American Jewish trad fam guy here, agree with so much of this great conversation.
Thank you
very much, Robert. Appreciate that. All right. Well, guys, as I said, make sure that you go ahead and check out all of Peachy's work, check out her book and everything. And of course, if it's your first time on this channel, make sure you go ahead, subscribe, turn on the notifications, hit the bell so that you can watch these streams when they go live. If you'd like to get these broadcasts as podcasts, you need to go to your favorite podcast platform and subscribe to the Orr McIntyre Show when you do leave a rating or review. And of course, if you'd like to get my book when it comes out on May 7th, you need to go ahead and pre-order it on Amazon. You can do that now. Thank you once again, everyone, for watching. And as always, I'll talk to you next time.